That was probably what had caused the headaches, not causing them the way eye strain or an overload of noise would, but rather indicative of some sensory input problem that also knocked out the olfactory baseline. I got a bag of peanuts and sat on a bench in the park, trying for a few minutes not to think, just absorb sensation. One peanut for me, one for the pigeons, one for the squirrel, one for me. Flavor and texture were right, and the other senses seemed in order. Quiet, scraping shuffle of the pigeon's feet, the squirrel scolding, the hardness of the bench under and behind me. Central Park was subdued under the dusty heat, proper for the month and time of day, crowds watching the miniature boats race in the pond. When the peanuts were gone, I walked back downtown. The sidewalks were bustling with Saturday shoppers. The feeling of prosperity wouldn't last much longer. The seeds of Black Tuesday were long sown, and the crash was only a couple of months away. Other seeds were sown, too. I stopped in front of Scribner's bookstore and looked at the bestsellers in the window. Churchill's last volume of The World Crisis, 1918 to 1928, with its bitter, prophetic ending. It is in these circumstances that we entered upon that period of exhaustion that has been described as peace. Erich Maria Remarque's pacifist classic, All Quiet on the Western Front. I remembered Bruce kidding me about Hitler before I got in the machine. Did Remarque know that Hitler was one of his fellow soldiers in the front line at Passchendaele? Not at the time, almost certainly, but he would know later. 4 years from now, the author of Mein Kampf, Not in the Window, will take power and sentence Remarque to death, a traitor to the German cause. But his trenchmate will be safe over here, still doing the famous author cocktail party circuit. Hitler will arrest his sister as a substitute symbol and have her decapitated with an axe. I drew my face close to the window and could smell the glass warming in the sun, the slight tickle of dust, but nothing underneath. The bass level of traffic sound was low, too, but that was just the weekend. Was the lack of background smell enough to trigger headache? I had never heard of anything like that, and the literature search hadn't made me suspect anything. The two victims' medical records had shown nothing unusual in common, nothing linked to the time machine or any other experiences with virtuality. In observer mode, you can stop time for a minute or two. It's an effort, the mental equivalent of lifting and carrying. I didn't much like the sensation, but it was obviously time to try it. Look for a visual equivalent to the lack of background smell. I walked down Fifth Avenue toward 42nd Street, a nice busy corner full of data, where I'd come up onto street level a couple of hours before. Some people rushing, others strolling, tourists and window shoppers chatting, sharp tang of ozone as the trolley crackled and clanged by. I concentrated my effort. Light and color dimmed slightly, as if the sun had gone behind a cloud. Pedestrians stopped in mid-step. A child who was hopping off the curb was frozen in mid-air. Careful not to bump into anyone or anything, which I recalled would accumulate deferred pain that would come back all at once, I crept toward the closest couple, an attractive middle-aged woman in business attire, and her companion, a large, florid man with a cigar clenched in his scowl, sweat-stained seersucker suit a size too tight. There was pain between them. It crackled like static electricity. Where was it coming from? In this mode, I had a pure kind of objectivity. These two people were mathematical constructs that my team or its predecessors had generated to reflect our perceptions of that year before the crash. No one on that street was insignificant. Everyone was equally real. That was the essence of virtuality. No bit players. Everyone was an element of a fractal that added up to the whole, contained the whole. I studied the man and allowed time to slowly squeeze through him. With glacial slowness, he pulled the cigar from his lips, leaving a shred of tobacco on an incisor, which his tongue moved forward so he could blow it away with a puff that was like a kiss in reverse. He held the cigar out, regarding the ash, and took a slow breath in order to blow on it. The woman took in all of this with an unconscious familiarity that was part patience and part contempt. She hated his cigars, but loved him. In her time and place, she kept both feelings to herself. As they stepped off the curb to cross the street, she brushed him with her hip, a small physical reminder, and he raised his right hand, the one without the cigar, to touch her shoulder. He was a gangster. He owned a speakeasy and did loan sharking and had a part interest in a Harlem whorehouse. That was just business, though. I'd encountered him in 1929 before, and knew that he didn't really consider himself a criminal. He hadn't had this cloud of pain and sadness before, though. The life stories of people you meet in the time machine aren't scripted. Initial conditions are set up, and things happen, more or less, as in real life. A year like 1929, that gets a lot of traffic, becomes more complex than less popular ones. The characters grow, but they don't grow through time like actual people. They grow in place, so to speak, in the process of living through the same day thousands of times. Maybe the gangster was growing a conscience. Maybe his girlfriend was giving him some well-deserved grief. Could that be related to the client's headaches? To the olfactory deficit? There just might be a connection. The time machine's information storage is dynamic and complex, but not infinite. Maybe as the characters grow more complicated, the machine reallocates memory from the sensory surround to the people. The physical situation is supposed to have first priority. If the world isn't believable, the characters' actions aren't significant, but the machine decides how to partition things. Have to look into that. Time to leave. I took the box out of my pocket and pushed the red button. A memory. Night class at NYU every Wednesday after dinner, trying to stay awake for philosophies of social and religious morality. The professor is entertaining enough, it's just the time and the subject matter that make it hard to stay awake this fly-buzzing summer evening. He uses an old-fashioned blackboard. The dry chalk dust in the air tickles Jacob's nose, and he stays awake by repressing the urge to sneeze. Dr. Schaumann is one of the few normals left. He hid out during the war in a temple high in Tibet. Lot 92 never got to that altitude. It had taken him 7 years to make his way back to this university, which in 2045 had given him the sabbatical that saved his life. When he returned, he was offered the Becker-Sendrick process, but declined. It was contrary to his worldview as a Buddhist, but he would teach for food and shelter. He is physically remarkable for a man in his 70s. He can put one hand on a table and lean forward, his body weight balanced on his elbow until he is parallel to the floor, all the time talking with no strain in his voice. "Birth and death are both illusions," he says, balanced like a compass needle. "Your essence simply exists. When conditions are right for birth, you are born, and you go through life. When conditions are right for you to die, you do. But it's all illusion. Your essence is unchanged by those mundane trivialities." At 18, Jacob thinks the professor's crazy. A couple of hundred years later, he would not be so sure. 7. Memento Mori. The street dimmed out, and I was lying in the dark on a soft couch, communing with tubes and wires. I slid the catheter out carefully and was stripping off electrodes as the lights came on. The couch slid out to its prep position, and I sat up, blinking away dizziness. Rebecca handed me a glass of water, and I drank it. "Find anything?" "Think so. The olfactory substrate isn't coming through at all. If you'd never been to New York, you probably wouldn't notice it. But it doesn't smell that clean even on a Sunday morning after a spring rain. Not in 1929. She nodded and took the glass away. "I'm going to go observe 1930. If the substrate's gone there..." "Then we're in real trouble," I said. "But nobody's reported headaches from 1930? Nobody's been there in months. Okay, we'll compare notes when you come back out. Like hell, she handed me my clothes. You're going to sleep for at least 8 hours. You were beat when you went in. She looked at the wall clock. Meet you after lunch tomorrow. 1400 here. Yes, doctor. I did feel fatigued, the rush of observer mode washing away. I fumbled, zipping up the suit. Kate left a message. She'll be in on the next shuttle, but has a face meeting with public health right after. Home before dinner. Good. I was famished, as usual, after observer mode, but just made myself a cheese sandwich to last me till then. I ate it while I walked home, detouring down through the farms to snag a handful of grapes. At home, I poured a glass of wine, but couldn't stay awake long enough to finish it. Woke up to the smell of Kate fixing dinner, heating pasta she'd picked up at the mess. Just as soon not go out to eat, she said. I've been social all day. I checked the pot. What, no couscous? I brought it from the R's mess. They owe us 1,000,000 calories. It was a good-looking pasta primavera. I'd picked the herbs for it this morning. You solved the polymer mystery? Partway. We nailed down the source, but the loss vector isn't obvious. How did 1918 go? Pretty routine. Artifacts being in two places at once because of sloppy coordination. Rebecca fixed it in the buffer while I did 1929 New York City. I told her about the client's headaches and the olfactory deficit while she doled out the pasta and a salad. Smell is different from the other senses in the way the information is processed. The earliest mammals, the little ratty things that coexisted with the dinosaurs, stayed out of the way by only coming out at night, and so sight was less useful to them than smell. They developed a little gray matter, the neopallium, to deal with the elusive and ambiguous information that smells provide. After about 100 million years, the neopallium evolved into the human cerebral cortex without losing its preference for smell. So smells, whether dramatic as garlic or subliminal like Ode to New York City, go straight to the limbic system. Every other kind of sensory input is slowed down and evaluated in the thalamus. But not everybody smells the same thing in a given situation. The genetic machinery for perceiving smells has evidently worn out as humans evolved, but the loss is not expressed the same way in every individual. There are about 1,000 olfactory receptor genes in the human genome, but the nose knows only about 400 receptor proteins. The other 600 are pseudogenes. They're passed on like genes, but are just place markers, having lost their ability to function. What affects virtuality, normally, is that some of those pseudogenes are throwbacks and continue to function in some individuals, and so we all have a slightly different setup. If somebody comes out of the time machine with some idiosyncratic complaint, like the ocean smelled like rotten bananas, the first thing we do is genotype for active pseudogenes. But it doesn't work the other way. Everybody has the receptor proteins for things like sewage and exhaust, the main components of the New York City substrate. So this is sort of a reversal of the usual problem. I checked my watch. They'll be coming out of 29 in about 90 minutes. I ought to be there for the debriefing. Knock yourself out. Did they say that in 1929? Not till the 50s. You want to do something tonight? Sit and read, unless you have something in mind. Sounds like the cat's pajamas to me, or the bee's knees, the clam's garters. Nobody ever said that. Trust me, the frog's ankles, the elephant's arches. Any animals anything? Within reason. Like garters on an invertebrate? Reasonable. I put on some Sibelius while she served, and we ate on the small balcony overlooking the reservoir, the lake, and the rice paddies. 6 kayakers were engaged in a noisy race. That looks like fun, she said. Wonder how far ahead you have to schedule one. Reserve one for me, too. We can go bother the crayfish. They lived in the rice paddies, big ones you could almost catch with your bare hands, though if you caught one, you might regret it. Yeah, but I need some exercise now. Think I'll go down with you and stop off at the gym. As you say, knock yourself out. think I'll go back to bed after the debriefing.